Good morning, counsel. The panel was previously identified. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next case for court consideration.
This is A21-0111, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Luat Tukmakuuk Appellant.
Just a reminder to state your name as well as indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. Likewise, please pay attention to the timer, which appears in my upper left-hand corner. Each of you has 15 minutes. An additional 5 minutes is reserved for appellant counsel for rebuttal purposes. When you're ready to proceed, appellant counsel, you have the floor.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Your honors, counsel, my name is Mitch Zillman, certified student attorney with the Public Defender's Office, here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Luat Tukmakuuk. Mr. Tukmakuuk appeals his convictions because the district court in this case wrongly and prejudicially admitted several statements of identification made by the alleged victim, Mr. Alex Shalander. This violated both the confrontation clause as well as the rules of evidence. The state has conceded that the district court was wrong in its reasoning for admitting these statements in this case. And for the first time on appeal, the state argues that these statements were admissible under several hearsay exceptions. For various reasons, Your Honors, the state's arguments should fail and Mr. Tukmakuuk should be granted a new trial. First among the reasons the state's arguments should fail is that it forfeited these arguments by failing to raise them in the district court. While it's true, appellate courts can sometimes affirm a conviction on grounds other than those addressed in the district court. That's only true where, unlike here, the district court actually addressed those grounds and both of the parties litigated facts to allow the district court to make a decision on admissibility. There was no contested omnibus hearing or any other fact-finding process in this case that was directed at establishing facts to determine whether these statements fell under either the excited.
Mr. Zillman, Zillman, am I pronouncing that right?
Correct.
I didn't follow your argument. What do you mean that the state forfeited its argument? You're the appealing party.
The state waived its arguments regarding the hearsay exceptions in this case because it never raised any arguments. It never argued in the district court that the statements at issue here were admissible as hearsay exceptions. The district court simply found that these statements were not hearsay under Rule 801 of the Rules of Evidence.
But as an appellate court, do we not have the prerogative of affirming the district court for a different reason if in fact the record would support that?
Well, as I mentioned, Your Honors, the district court never made preliminary findings of fact on the admissibility, on the hearsay exception questions here. And even if you do find that the state didn't waive its arguments, which we think it did by failing to raise them at any point in these proceedings until now, the record does not support the state's argument on the excited utterance exception. The only facts the state points to are scattered pieces of testimony about Mr. Shalander's state of mind well before.
Mr. Zillman, if I can interrupt briefly just to make sure I understand your argument, it sounds like you're basically saying that because some of these hearsay exceptions that the state is putting forth as alternative bases for admissibility require specific facts, and if the record isn't developed enough on those facts, then we could not affirm on those alternative grounds of admissibility. Is that basically what I hear you saying? Less about waiver and more about a lack of development in the record and what that practically means for our decision regarding those alternative grounds.
That's exactly correct, Your Honors. And that's really the difference between this case and some of these other cases where the appellate courts used alternative grounds, because the appellate court didn't have to find any facts. In this case, you would have to find facts by at least a preponderance of the evidence under Rule 104A to support admission of these identifying statements under any hearsay exception. And because the district court never applied its discretion to those exception questions, this court should not now address them. If I can, unless I can answer more questions on that argument, I would turn to the fact that the state in this case violated appellant's confrontation rights by offering these out-of-court statements. So even if the state didn't waive its argument, its hearsay exception arguments, it violated confrontation to admit these statements because Shalander gave these statements and the officers elicited them to gather evidence to prosecute the suspects of this burglary.
But the individuals you're talking about, let's talk about the victim, Shalander. He testified, so he was available to be cross-examined, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So and in what way was the right to confront a witness not met?
Well, I would clarify that unavailability standard means that in order to admit an out-of-court testimonial statement, the state has to show that the declarant was unavailable. Mr. Shalander was available here, and the state nonetheless did not ask him about these identifying statements. And I would also point out that that Mr. Shalander was not subject to cross-examination about them under Minnesota's own rules of evidence, because defense counsel's cross-examination was limited to what Mr. Shalander discussed on direct, as well as matters pertaining to credibility.
But go ahead.
I was just going to follow. Maybe we're saying the same question here. It seems the difficulty here is you have one rule of evidence that says the scope of your cross-examination is limited to the scope of the direct. And you have another rule of evidence that says as long as they're available for cross-examination regarding this statement, then that under the confrontation clause, potentially also under the hearsay exception, you would have admissibility of something that you otherwise wouldn't have. So it sounds like what we're dealing with is what happens when the confrontation clause can't be satisfied. In other words, the defense can't ask those additional questions without violating the first rule that limits the scope of cross-examination. So what happens when you're unable to ask a witness about something because that was not asked on direct, right? That's essentially the issue that we're having to step into here. Is that right, Mr. Zillman?
I would say that's one of the issues. It's correct that we think that when a rule of evidence constricts defense counsel's cross-examination so that they can't vindicate the defendant's right to confrontation, they effectively, the declarant is effectively not subject to cross-examination to satisfy the confrontation clause. But additionally, Mr. Shalander was present at the trial. He testified. There was nothing keeping him from testifying about these statements of identification, which is also a requirement of the confrontation clause, namely that the declarant be unavailable. And because the circumstances of the identifications in this case indicate that these statements were made for purposes of a prosecution, namely, the show-up procedure was conducted in a very controlled environment. It was not, in a frantic setting. I would actually point the court to State versus Sutter, 959 Northwest 2nd, 760 at pages 767 through 68. In that case, our Supreme Court noted that, that a statement was given for purposes of a prosecution because the declarant didn't describe events as they were happening. They were events from earlier. The declarant, like here, was not actually a victim of an ongoing emergency. Mr. Shalander was, he was safe. The police had intervened at the time. Nobody expressed any concerns for safety, and Mr. Shalander's statements and the procedure itself, they were not, frantic or in an unsafe environment. So these statements were given for purposes of prosecuting the suspects. And for that reason, and because Mr. Shalander was available and not subject to cross-examination regarding these statements, the state actually fails to satisfy any of the prongs necessary to admit a hearsay statement against a criminal defendant.
So I just want to be clear here. You're not challenging the court's ruling on the show up. You're challenging the trial testimony that the officer gave. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So, you know, Mr. Shalander testified, talked about what happened, maybe gave some vague descriptions about his assailants, didn't talk about the show up procedure. But it seems to me, I can't imagine that there's a district court judge in the state that would have prohibited someone from asking him on cross-examination about, if they wanted to, about his identification. I mean, you can only speculate why the state didn't, and maybe that's because Mr. Shalander was no longer a very cooperative witness. So I don't know, I guess it doesn't matter, but to me, I think you have very strong arguments on the error that the court made in admitting this testimony. I'm less convinced that you can show that your client was prejudiced by those rulings, considering all the evidence that was recovered almost immediately that directly tied him to the crime, including the DNA evidence on the gun. So maybe in the last couple minutes, you could help me understand how, even if these rulings were error, your client was somehow prejudiced or the verdict would have been different had they not have been admitted.
Yes, so as I understand it, there are sort of two questions in there, Your Honor. The first pertains to Rule 801 and the district court, whether that was an error and whether they could have allowed Mr. Shalander to testify about the statements.
And you all agree that that was error, right? I mean, yes. The state has conceded that in its brief.
Okay, so as to the prejudice prong, I would point out first that because there's a confrontation violation here, you have to find the error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And moreover, in several of our Supreme Court's opinions, including State versus Sanders and State v. Al-Nasir from 2005, that's 690 Northwest 2nd, 744, you know, even if there's not a confrontation violation, the constitutional harmless error standard should apply because Mr. McQuatch's confrontation rights were implicated here. And moreover, from State versus Harris says that evidence of guilt is not the only factor that the court should consider when determining prejudice or harmlessness, and that even strong evidence of guilt, even if you think that the state's evidence is strong here, that can't substitute for a fair trial with fair procedures. And as we've outlined in our brief, we think that the way that this trial unfolded rendered appellant's trial unfair. Moreover, you know, we cited various literature demonstrating that eyewitness identifications are highly persuasive, especially when made in terms of high percentages like they are here. Moreover, the prosecutor extensively highlighted these statements in his closing argument. Defense counsel, you know, she pointed to them somewhat, but she was not able to cross-examine these statements, and she was not able to say that, you know, in the absence of these identifications, she couldn't argue that there were no identifications of the defendant, whether in court or out of court. Without these identifications that the district court wrongly admitted, there wouldn't have been any identification of Mr. McQuatch at trial. Moreover, you know,
why would that be prejudicial considering the other evidence linking him to the crime that the jury had before it?
Well, you know, some of the state's evidence is not as probative, I think, as their brief might suggest. For example, the DNA evidence doesn't show when Mr. McQuatch ever touched the firearm at issue. Some of the video evidence is very, you know, it doesn't show us much. It shows a silhouette. You know, there's some testimony from one of Mr. McQuatch's co-defendants' fathers indicating that he never saw him at his house that night or at his apartment when they claimed that they deposited the stolen items there. And moreover, you know, Mr. Shalander's testimony was, or I should say his hearsay testimony through the police officers was was that of a first person eyewitness, and it made it seem, you know, artificially more persuasive to the jury. And I would just again come back to the fact that strong evidence of guilt is not enough to negate the prejudice in this case. And another case that says that is State versus Caulfield. That's 722 Northwest 2nd, 304 at page 314. And so unless you have any more questions on that prong, Your Honor, I would conclude there and reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
There appears to be no questions. We'll turn it over to respondent counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Lydia Villalba-Lijo, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The state is asking this court to affirm Mr. McQuatch's convictions, because if the district court erred in admitting the show-up statements, that error was harmless. There were multiple pieces of other credible evidence identifying Mr. McQuatch and connecting him to the offenses at issue here. And that evidence included Mr. Shalander's detailed identifications of the intruders, including Mr. McQuatch, his descriptions of the firearms, and his descriptions of the getaway car that he included in his 911 call and in his on-scene statements to police. In addition to the statements that he made at the time of the immediate offense, Mr. Shalander testified in great detail about the offenses that occurred. His testimony is, again, very detailed and very compelling, and literally provides a step-by-step description of what precisely occurred. Now, in addition to those other detailed identifications that Mr. Shalander provided, there's also video evidence that reveals that there were three men at Mr. Shalander's home, and that those three men matched the descriptions that he provided. Shortly after the 911 call, officers saw a car that matched the description of the getaway car that Mr. Shalander provided on his 911 call. And as it turned out, Mr. McQuatch and two other men, including CB, were in the vehicle. Within 2 to 3 hours of the offenses, officers found Mr. Shalander's property inside the bedroom closet of CB's bedroom. Officers also found a gun inside of CB's bedroom closet that had Mr. McQuatch's DNA on it. So this is other additional evidence besides the show-up statements that very strongly connects Mr. McQuatch to these offenses. Now, in addition to this,
Ms. Lijo, if I could jump in, sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I look at the factors that we consider to determine the heightened prejudice standard, I think the ones that weigh strongest against the state and in favor of reversal would be the emphasis during closing argument on the show-up identification, as well as the jury question. So I'd like you to address kind of how you balance those factors and which ones, if any, is the state conceding might weigh against them. And to the extent that this is really about how overwhelming does the court believe the evidence to be, I think that would be helpful for us to know if that's really the main issue we would consider is how strong or how overwhelming is it? And is it overwhelming enough for the state to establish what it has to on the constitutional prejudice test?
Well, Your Honor, the state certainly argues that the evidence is strong enough to uphold this conviction. With regard to the presentation of this evidence at trial, the trial record shows that the judge gave the jury cautionary instructions on the use of the proper use of the evidence identification, or the identification evidence, I should say. That certainly favors affirmance and supports the harmless nature of any error. You referred to closing argument. while the defense very effectively and aggressively attempted or did counter the show-up statements and evidence, identification evidence overall in its closing argument. So this was a case where it was part of the state's closing argument, but it was also even a more prominent part of the defense's closing argument, and they effectively met the challenge. With regard to the jury note really indicates that the jury viewed the show-up statements in a skeptical manner, which also suggests that they likely did not give it a lot of weight in their deliberations. What that note said, or what that note asked, was why didn't AS get asked about the show-up details in his testimony or viewing the car so that it is not hearsay? This question really strongly suggests that the jury is carefully looking at the evidence, they're evaluating it carefully, and some skepticism here, which suggests, again, the harmless nature of the use of the show-up statements. It's very clear here, there's a very strong trial record of guilt, of Mr. Quach's guilt and involvement in this offense. And it also establishes that the show-up statements did not lead to Mr. McQuash's convictions. As part of its harmless error analysis, this court can consider whether the show-up statements were admissible under other exceptions. The state has offered the excited utterance exception and has also offered the residual hearsay exception with regard to the statements made about the car. If this court finds that the statements about the car do not qualify as excited utterances. Now, in its letter of supplemental authorities to the court, the state has identified cases that do support the this court's discretion to consider whether the show-up statements were admissible under other exceptions. And those states, those cases were the two Robinson cases, State versus Hogevet, and State versus Openshaw.
Ms. Lee Holt, again, yes, if I could interrupt, I think to get to the point of, or the part of it that I'm struggling with a bit on the alternative grounds for admissibility, I do think that Mr. Zillman is correct, that there are some foundational facts or some development of the record that would have occurred had these been the grounds on which the state had offered the evidence in the first instance. And so my question is, what happens if we look at this record and think that it is not developed enough for us to say whether either exception applies? Is a lack of support in the record for a foundational fact necessary to make this admissibility ruling, wouldn't that remove those alternative grounds from our consideration?
Your Honor, if this court finds that it cannot consider whether the show-up statements were admissible as excited utterances or under the residual hearsay exception, or whether there's an insufficient foundation at trial, this court can still affirm the convictions. And that is because there is extremely strong other evidence aside from the show-up statements. The show-up statements in and of themselves are only one piece of a much larger whole here. There's video evidence, there's DNA evidence, there is very strong, detailed, and compelling testimony by Mr. Shalander at trial that would support affirmance. Even if this court decides that the record to evaluate the show-up statements under other exceptions is not available.
It seems to be, if I could interrupt you, along the lines of Judge Bryan's questions on your alternative grounds, it does seem like an appellate court would need to engage in fact finding, which we can't do. For instance, the court's observations of a witness in evaluating an excited utterance objection or a ground for admission is often an important consideration. We don't have the benefit of that. And I think that the need for fact-finding, I guess, is where I'm struggling the most in considering these alternative grounds.
Your Honor, I'd like to respond to that, if I may. I think that there are some very key facts that are available in the trial record that very strongly support a finding that the statements were admissible as excited utterances. First is the nature of the event itself, and that is that AS was in bed in the middle of the night. He's alone in his home when three intruders pushed their way inside the home. They held him at gunpoint, they ransacked his home, and they stole his property. Mr. McClosh pointed a gun at Mr. Shalander and threatened to shoot him by asking, which pick a leg, I think was the statement. This is the type of deeply stressful, deeply fear-causing event that type of fear and excitement would not have dissipated or evaporated within 1 hour. Now, only 1 hour passed from the time of the event around midnight to the time of the show up at 1 a.m. in the morning. That's a very compressed, very tight timeline. And it also supports that the deep stress that Mr. Shalander would have been under as a result of that event would still have existed. But we also have Mr. Shalander's own words. We have his words on the 911 call. He is audibly excited. He refers to himself as either freaking out or tweaking out. When he testified at trial, he candidly acknowledged that when he was threatened with being shot directly, he freaked out was the word that he used. And he also described being very fearful that he would be accidentally shot during this incident. He described that he has a background as a hunter, and he was very fearful of being injured accidentally. In addition to that, even after police arrived at the scene, Mr. Shalander testified that his adrenaline was still pumping and that he was in a haze. And his deep state of upset was confirmed at trial by Officer Clinton's testimony, describing him as upset. So there's a strong trial record that supports a finding that that these were excited utterances based on the nature of the event and based on the words of Mr. Shalander and the testimony of Officer Clinton. And it's very clear that within a compressed amount of time, he would have remained in a state of excitement. I'm sorry, Your Honor. You appear to want to follow up?
I don't know if it matters, but I mean, I agree that that evidence is in the record, but it kind of begs the question then, why did the state ignore it and not ask those questions at trial? We wouldn't have to address them at this point on alternative grounds.
I can understand why the court is wondering about that. The record does not explain to us why the approach was taken that it was. And I certainly don't have any personal knowledge about that. But I think there is a very strong trial record here in multiple ways. I think it supports the harmless nature of this error here. And certainly Mr. McQuatch has not raised a sufficiency argument that the evidence was insufficient, because in fact, it's very strong here. I'll just briefly address the restitution issue, or if there's any further questions, I'm happy to take them. Restitution is also an issue in this case. Mr. McQuatch has argued that he's challenging the district court's legal authority to order restitution, but he failed under State versus Gayovnik to first challenge the restitution or to first raise the legal challenge in the district court, and he has forfeited that now on appeal. The state is asking this court to remand the case for the extremely limited purpose of allowing the district court to make findings regarding Mr. McQuash's ability to pay within 1 year or
two. I think I misunderstood your argument. Are you arguing that because there was not a petition to address restitution, that he waived his right to appeal? If he waived his right to appeal, why would we send it back to the district court? I just want to be clear on what your argument is.
The argument is he has completely forfeited the right to challenge restitution, period.
Ms. Leho, if I can jump in, because I thought that your argument was that there's there are different aspects of the restitution award that are being challenged. On one hand, challenging the amount, to challenge the connection of the restitution to the nexus, if you will, that causation piece, that may be forfeited, but you're asking us to remand for the court to consider ability to pay, which you don't think was forfeited.
I would agree with you, Judge Bryan, in your view of how this issue or our position is. Mr. McQuatch has forfeited his right to challenge the amount of the restitution, period. However, the record does not indicate that the district court does not reflect that the district court considered Mr. McQuash's ability to pay, nor does it explain why the district court ordered the payment to be made within 1 year. And so therefore the state is simply asking for a very limited remand that would allow the district court to make findings on Mr. McQuash's ability to pay within 1 year or to modify that payment schedule. So it's a very limited request. I hope that's clear.
Thank you. Your time has expired. We appreciate those comments. And back to you, Mr. Zillman. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Maybe we should talk about restitution first.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 2 points, but just to quickly address restitution, I would just note that the substance of our argument is that the question of whether damages were a direct result of the offense, that's a legal question. It's not a factual question, and we don't dispute the facts here on appeal. And because the answer to that legal question is no, the district court in this case did not have authority to enter restitution on the basis that that the state and Mr. Shalander claimed. The two other points I have are that first, I would rest on our arguments regarding the insufficient facts in the record to establish a hearsay exception. But in addition to that, I would note that, you know, as you've noted, Your Honors, the district court did not address these hearsay exception questions and the parties never litigated over them. We don't know what the record would have looked like had defense counsel had the opportunity to challenge the facts, you know, that would have underlied this this hearsay exception. So for that reason, there aren't enough facts in the record to show excited utterance because, you know, there are not enough facts in the record, and more facts could have been established to dispute the hearsay exceptions. And then finally, I want to talk about the prejudice or harmlessness prong in this case. I just would like to reiterate that part of the harmlessness analysis is not just looking at the strength of the state's evidence. It's looking at the unfairness as well as the strength of the erroneously admitted evidence. And in this case, it was very strong evidence. It was an identification from the only firsthand witness. If without that evidence, the evidence at trial, in fact, would have only been circumstantial. So that, you know, further increases the impact of this evidence, because it would have taken us from a case with some direct evidence to a case based purely on circumstantial evidence. In addition, I would just like to speak about the jury question. The state says that it shows the jury was evaluating the evidence carefully, but, you know, it just as easily could be the case that it meant they were really thinking about and finding important those identifications, and they wanted to make sure that they were reliable. And the jurors could have found that the district court in this case not answering that question was more or less a confirmation of reliability. Again, I would note that defense counsel, you know, she was not able to say that there was no identification at this trial because the district court admitted these this evidence. She was not able to counter this evidence, in other words. And I would also just point out that a lot of the facts that state's counsel cited for, you know, to counteract the wrong admission of these identifications don't really go much to the issue of identity. They simply go to, you know, whether Mr. Shalander accurately perceived what happened in this case. And, you know, the in the absence of those identifications that were wrongly admitted here, you know, Mr. Shalander's detailed testimony about what happened doesn't tell us much about the suspect's identity. It doesn't fill in that gap that is left by that evidence not being present. So those facts are not, they don't counteract the prejudice in this case. And because the erroneously admitted statements were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, Mr. McQuad should be granted a new trial. I'm happy to field any more questions at this time if you have them, Your Honors.
It appears not. Thank you to both of you for appearing today on our Zoom platform. The matters are deemed submitted and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.